some interviews. So first up, I have an interview with Ken Bozum of Little Sisters, which is an independent bookstore in Vancouver's Davie Village. And it's been known for its legal battles with Canadian border services and activism against censorship. Then we're going to hear Tell Me a Story from Skylar Kergel, followed by Robert Frost from Malblum. Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium has been a staple of Vancouver's LGBTQ community since 1983. Ken Bozum has worked at Little Sisters for the past 11 years. He spoke with me about the changes he has seen at the store and in the community. What made you want to work here?
Originally, I had come from the Okanagan, where I was one of the people that helped found Pride in the Okanagan back in the mid-90s, and I'd always been part of sort of queer groups and education and that kind of stuff. And so it was kind of a good fit when I was looking for a job, and Little Sisters seemed like a good place to go. Yeah.
What's your favorite part about working here?
I guess my favorite part about working here is just the people. You get to meet everybody. It's kind of, especially at Pride, it's kind of a clearinghouse for information for where to go. And if people come from out of town, they kind of come here first to find out where to go and get their bearings. And you kind of get to see everybody. It's kind of the crossroads for gay everything in Vancouver, kind of.
So Little Sisters has played a big role in the LGBTQ community in Vancouver. Could you maybe walk me through briefly, like a little bit of the history about Little Sisters?
Sure. Little Sisters opened in 1983 at a different location to where it is now. And within about 2 years of their opening, they started getting material seized by Canada Customs. And that eventually turned into a 15-year or so court battle that involved all kinds of craziness. And so it's hard to imagine now in a world where everything is a button click away to get information on everything. But when the case first started, magazines were like the most timely way to get current information. And so at the height of, or the beginning of kind of the AIDS epidemic, the parts of magazines that came with like the top 10 safer sex things would all be whited out or blacked out and censored. So you'd have to get on the phone from here and phone somebody in the States and say, like, can you turn to page, like, whatever, and can you read to me the things that we're supposed to be doing to not kill each other? If that would be great. And so that was getting seized. Over time, eventually, it became clear that we were being targeted, specifically because we were a gay bookstore. At one point, they even seized a box that never crossed the border, but Border Services managed to get a hold of it and open it and decide that we shouldn't have it, even though it was coming from Ontario, and it just got sort of wacky. So it's kind of hard now to think that it matters that you would not be able to get a book or a magazine, because now it's everything's so at your fingertips, but at the time, it was a very big deal for the community, for sure.
And how have you seen Little Sisters change during the time you've been here?
In the time I've been here, it's changed in a huge way, I think, just partly because of all of that sort of digitization of our society. So like roughly about 45% of all book sales now are digital and never touch a brick and mortar or anything. So our book department has shrunken quite a lot, and we've got more adult stuff, more underwear, more Pride stuff, that kind of thing. So what we sold has kind of shifted, but that it's kind of always been that way at the store. Like long before I came along, they used to sell really horrible homemade coffee in a styrofoam cup for 50 cents, or they even sold cigarettes back in the day. Like they've always kind of shifted and changed to meet what people are looking for. So,
And how would you say the activism has changed? Mm-hmm.
Some of the activism I find has changed, partly because a lot of the activism was around the case and around sort of public free speech and civil rights and that kind of stuff. In some ways, that's changed in the sense that a lot of the things that we were sort of traditionally fighting for as a community, we've kind of got, but other sort of parts of the community don't have those things yet. So, for example, the trans community right now is kind of where the gay community was back in the 70s, so they're starting to get a flag, and they're starting to get Pride material, and they're starting to get, the bulk of literature is developing around that. And so some of it is just the shift between, like, which part of the community is kind of the focus of activism at that point in history. Some of it, I think, has changed a bit over time because there's only one of the two founders left, and he's an older guy now. Janine, who was our long-time manager, has sort of gone on an extended medical leave now. And Jim has passed away, and those were kind of the three, kind of the holy trinity of Little Sisters, kind of. And so I think there's less of an active activist bent maybe to management now, but the store definitely is still behind all of those ideas, for sure. But I think there's less maybe actual active street-level flag-waving going on around it, partly because the case isn't going on either.
Can you tell me a bit more about those three people?
Sure. So the store was actually founded by Jim Diva, his partner Bruce Smith, and another woman named Barb Thomas, who was only there for the first few months, and then they kind of parted company, and then it was just Jim and Bruce from then on. And then Jim passed away about 2 years ago, and so Bruce is still one of the owners. But they're really the start of it all. That's where it all began. And then about 7 to 8-ish years after they started, I think, Janine came along, and they were kind of looking for somebody to help expand and bring more women in and that kind of thing. And a lot of people actually, to this day, think Janine is one of the owners because she was so sort of at the front of all the court case material and that kind of thing. But all three of them are great. I mean, Janine's a great Amazon. She's if you need somebody to lead the charge, Janine's the person to go to for sure. And they've all been very active. They're all very intellectually sort of aware of what's going on politically and all of that kind of stuff.
And what impact do you think Little Sisters has had more broadly within, like, BC or Canada?
Well, on a personal level, actually, as a kid, one of the first things I saw on TV or anywhere that told me that there was gay anything outside of sort of pop culture or, like, New York, or was actually hearing about one of the three bombings that the store had to go through on the news. And even though it was a horrible thing to hear, that told me that in Vancouver, where I went one or three times a year, there was people like me, right? And so I think some of it has just been to let people know there is a place. I think that's part of the reason the store got bombed three times was because we were saying, hey, there's a place. And so that, thankfully, is in the past, all the horrible terrorist stuff, but I think it's still that place. And so I think a lot of people sort of look at it as their home away from home, and a lot of people in the West End sort of bought property out in the suburbs when the interest rates were good. And so sometimes during the week it feels less like the gayborhood in the Davie Village because there's less gay people here. They're all living in Surrey or Coquitlam. But then on Sunday everybody kind of comes back, and it's kind of like going home to visit on Sunday. Like, you come down, you sort of cruise around, you hang out with people who are like you, and you kind of get your fix for that, I think. So I think it's kind of become sort of an unofficial, it's almost an unofficial community center, even though we have a community center.
And how else do you think Vancouver's LGBTQ community has changed?
I think it's been a big shift sort of with everybody else over time. We've gone from where, like, gay bars were only in the sort of low-rent downtown Skid Road sort of part of town, and if you wanted to go for a beer, you had to go and drink with sort of, you know, like you were on the downtown east side, basically. And that's changed. We've kind of come out of the darkness and into the light a bit, I think, over time. Like, the first legally licensed gay bar in BC was in about 1968 or 69. And now we've had way more bars than that, and then now way less bars than that again because of the epidemic and everything that's changed the community too. So I think there's been all kinds of sort of things we've had to leap through.
What do you think are the challenges that are facing the LGBTQ community and Little Sisters now?
I think it's a combination of things. I think with the sort of digitization of everything, I think it's sort of scattered community a bit. We used to have bar spaces where we would sort of go to meet people, and now you have apps, so you don't have to leave your apartment and you can meet people. I was joking with somebody a while ago, we had an old used porn mag came in, and it had this full-page ad for a computer dating service, and it said you could meet as many as 10 to 15 guys in a month. And I'm like, well, now you can meet 10 to 15 guys in 5 minutes because you have an app, and then you scroll and you get another 10 to 15 guys, and you get another 10 to 15 guys, you know? So it's really changed kind of how we, I think, interact in a one-on-one way. And so that's happened. I think, as I said, the trans community has really expanded and exploded and are really coming into their own. So that's kind of shifted and changed. We still have bisexuals who complain that there's not enough for everybody. I think it's like anything, time goes by and sort of things shift around, but yeah, I think it's just sort of a matter of keeping a steady slide and trying to move on in the future.
And so there's been a lot of talk about, like, the mainstreaming of gay culture has sort of weakened activism, I guess. What's your thoughts on that?
It's interesting. Historically, I think Jim and Bruce and Janine all are kind of philosophically, I think they agree that it's great that everybody has a right to get married, but I don't think they philosophically think that's necessarily the way for the gay community to go, and that there's sort of a split in the gay community, I think, between people who are kind of more conservative and want, you know, marriage and adoption and the military and all of those things, and then people who are sort of old school queer people who think, well, marriage is a failed institution. Like, why are we trying to get into on a bus that's totally going off the road? Like, that makes no sense, right? And so those people are like, polyamory is where it's at. Like, you know, we should have open relationships. That should be allowed. Like, we should be able to have a three-way marriage if we have two partners instead of one. And so I think there's a split across the community in that regard. And so it's sort of a, on the one hand, we have, you know, books like The Ethical Slut that tell you how to deal with polyamory and having an open relationship, and then we also have same-sex wedding toppers, right? So we try to sort of appeal to everybody, whether we agree with it philosophically or not, I guess. Yeah.
I think that's all the questions that I had. Yeah. If there's anything you think I missed or want to add.
this year, our only sort of real big extra pride excitement is just that Jim and Diva Plaza is about to open. So it's kind of neat to have something named after one of our founders just on the other end of the block. It's nice.
Oh, could you tell me a bit about that?
Sure. So it's actually Jim Diva Plaza is going to actually be a city. It's actually a city park, essentially. It's the first of what they're calling plazas. So it's a kind of a flagship project to hopefully they're going to work. But it's basically sort of somewhere between a no traffic street and a park. And so there'll be seating, there's going to be a sculptural installation that weighs, I forget how many tons, but it's a huge metal loudspeaker, basically, like a big megaphone, as sort of as a speaker's corner. So to sort of symbolize Jim's commitment to free speech and that kind of thing, there's this huge megaphone where you can go and stand on the soapbox and tell everybody what you think. but it's supposed to be a sort of an open-use space so people can apply to use the space for events and that kind of thing. They're trying to pack it with programming so community groups can go and set up and use it for this, that, and the other thing. And yeah, it should be good.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
No worries.
Strangers staring, they want to be the first to ask for my life in one word. Not that simple. Why do you care to know? Am I a boy or a girl? Well, I don't care about the answers. The questions were boring. Please tell me a story. Now, what did your mom say? What is your real name? How about those drugs that you take? And does your voice change? How come you don't feel ashamed? What kind of love do you make? We don't care about my answers. Your questions ignore me. Let me tell you a story. Dropped octaves, 'cause I am a mountain range, and any kind of love's good enough to be made. But I don't care about the answers. The questions were boring. Please tell me a story.
Robert Frost, if I wrote a poem about the weather, it would start in my car, digging out for an hour. And this town is all just dirt and earth and a little lie and a bigger hurt. No, I shouldn't have left my house in the first place, I guess, but I always go back to what I'm meant to be. I go back to what I'm meant to be. On a polar high that I found one night, it was cold outside. Where your frozen hands are so much like mine, but they don't compromise. Now I'm inking at the ground because I don't want you to leave. I know it's codependent, but I think it's kind of sweet. Out of every person in this city I could ever meet, leaving feels like losing, but I'm learning what I need. I go back to where I'm meant to be. I go back. I Robert Frost. I wish that I'd replied. I wish he hadn't died. I wish a lot of things. The day you lost your dog and I lost my car was a Saturday, but the frozen air, frozen ice, and the biggest hurts and the boldest lies are gonna disappear like the melting point, like my melting rules, like my melting life. I go back to where I'm meant to be. I go back to where I'm meant to be.
So you just listened to Robert...
So it's a charming disposition you could call...
That was just Robert Frost by Mal Bloom, and before that was Tell Me a Story by Skylar Kergel. I'm going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned to right here on CITR for more great Pride programming.
Hi, you're listening to CITR. My name is Paula, and this is Pride Facts. I have some info on same-sex marriage around the world. There are 200 countries in the world, and as of 2016, only 23 have legally recognized same-sex marriage. The first country to introduce equal marriage was the Netherlands in 2000. 10 years later was Argentina, followed by Uruguay and Brazil in 2013, and Colombia in 2016. In Europe, same-sex marriage legislation varies from country to country. Denmark was the first country in the world to give legal recognition to same-sex couples in the form of domestic partnerships in 1989. Ireland, formerly known as one of the most conservative and religious countries in Europe, voted for the legalization of same-sex marriage through a public referendum in 2015. Same-sex marriage remains illegal in most Eastern European countries, and they don't recognize same-sex civil unions. Canada passed the Civil Marriage Act recognizing equal marriage nationwide in 2005. The trend towards equal marriage legislation since the year 2000 is cause for much optimism. However, same-sex marriage is still illegal in most of the world, so the fight for marriage equality continues. Happy Pride, everyone.
Strength, dignity, respect,
beauty,
self-worth,
safety,
confidence,
choice,
hope.
The Beauty Night Society is a registered charity dedicated to helping marginalized women introduce trust, hope, and self-esteem into their lives.
This is the first day of
Through its popular makeover program, the Beauty Night Society has touched the lives of thousands and reintroduced a healthy touch to the lives of vulnerable women throughout British Columbia, creating real life makeovers.
Please visit www.beautynight.org for information on programs and on how to help.
Beauty Night, because dignity is beautiful.
I think I was blind before I met you.
How do you listen to CITR? Do you stream it with your data? You could be getting it free on your phone with the already installed FM receiver chip, but major carriers have blocked access to it. If you want access to all your favorite CITR goodness on your phone, get involved. Visit freeradiomyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
Welcome back. You're listening to Pride programming on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver, or streaming from CITR.ca. We're broadcasting from UBC on unceded Musqueam territory. Up next, I have an interview with Chris Morrissey, one of the founders of Rainbow Refugee, based here in Vancouver. Following that, we'll listen to Savannah by The Clicks and The Beast Is Me by Ray Spoon, who are both Canadian artists. And then we'll hear Body Was Made by Ezra Furman.
While Canada's LGBTQ community continues to face many challenges, they made some of the greatest strides in gaining rights in the world. The International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association lists 73 countries with anti-gay criminal laws. And in 10 countries, being gay or bisexual is still punishable by death. Rainbow Refugee is a Vancouver organization that supports LGBTQ and HIV-positive asylum seekers, refugee claimants, and refugees. I spoke with Chris Morrissey from Rainbow Refugee to learn more about the organization and the challenges facing LGBTQ migrants today. Could you tell me a little bit about what Rainbow Refugee is or what they do?
Sure. Rainbow Refugee has been around since 2000. And in 2011, we started to provide drop-in sessions for LGBT folks here in Canada who were afraid to return to their countries because of a fear of persecution as a result of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or HIV positive status. And so for the last 15 years, we've been doing that on a regular basis. Since 2011, we've also been in a relationship with the federal government to actually sponsor LGBT folks from overseas, also who are escaping persecution from their own countries. We also do education with settlement agencies that are here, providing services in the Lower Mainland. Since we're all volunteers, there's a limit to what we're able to do. So we're not able to do a whole lot around settlement. So our approach is to provide education to those agencies and organizations that do a lot of the settlement work.
And how have you seen things change through the organization over the years?
Well, over the years, one of the things that's changed is that we've seen an increase in the number of women that are able to get to Canada in some capacity or other, which is in the beginning when we first began, almost all of the folks who came to our drop-in sessions, almost all were gay men. More recently, we've seen an increase in the number of lesbians, which is great to see. There's also been a shift in terms of when we first started, a lot of the folks who came were from Central and South America. These days, we're seeing more people from the Middle East and, interestingly, from a number of African countries. And this is quite a new phenomenon. So it's great to see that there are people who are able to get out of their country and to actually get here to Canada. Also, we've seen a shift in terms of, because of over time, we've seen lots more folks go through the process. And so now on our board, we have a number of members of the board are people who have themselves come as refugees and who have become permanent residents and in some cases already citizens. So it's great that we're now able to make sure that some folks who have had that direct experience themselves are actually able to be on the board of the organization.
And what would you say are the challenges facing these communities and the organization?
Well, one of the challenges that faces us is that we are all volunteers. I mean, we've all been doing this since 2011. All of those of us who are volunteers, we've been doing it off the side of our desks when people are working and have jobs. I happen to be retired, so I don't have a desk anymore. But we don't have any funding to enable us to do more organizational work. So that certainly is one of the challenges. In terms of the work we do, because we've got the sponsorship program, which is a national program, it takes a lot of work to get groups of people organized together and to raise the funds that are required for sponsorship. I mean, one of the challenges is certainly here in Vancouver in the Lower Mainland and also in Ontario is the cost of housing. And so, for example, in order to sponsor a gay or lesbian couple, the group that's doing the sponsorship has to raise anywhere between $25,000 and $30,000. That's a lot of money to raise. And so the cost of housing here in Vancouver and in other parts of the country is a huge challenge.
And so there's also been changes to Canada's immigration policy over the years. How has that affected the organization?
Well, the latest changes, the more recent changes, saw the change in the processing times, particularly for folks making applications from inside Canada. And so it went from a situation where sometimes people were waiting for a year and a half before they had their hearing to now be in a position where within 2 months they have a hearing. So it's kind of the pendulum has swung from one extreme to the other. So currently one of the challenges that we're seeing in Canada is the fact that it takes time for people to get documents, translated, and to prepare to go for their hearing. I mean, one of the challenges for individual people is that they have spent most of their life in their home countries being very closeted. And so when it comes then to making a refugee claim, whether it's in Canada or whether it's from overseas, the basis of their claim is their sexual orientation or their gender identity or the HIV positive status. And so suddenly they go from a situation where they've had to be extremely closeted, extremely careful, to now needing to trust authorities in terms of entrusting them with the information about themselves and their lives in order for them to be able to make a successful claim.
And why is it important for you to do this work?
Well, one of the things is that I think that, you know, we've done a lot of work here in Canada in terms of our own lives and our own community, and I think we're in a really privileged place at the moment. I mean, many of us have lots of benefits. Relationships are recognized to the point where if couples choose, they can be married. There's the adoption of children, even more recently with three or more parents. So we've managed to get ourselves into a place through a lot of work, for sure, but we're now in a place where we enjoy a lot of privilege. And so for me, it's really important that we look at ourselves in terms of a global context, because there's not just us here, that we also have members of our community in many parts of the world where they experience threats to their lives and to their safety. And I mean, there's still, 10 countries in some part of it that have the death penalty. There's 73 countries in the world that still criminalize homosexuality. So I think we do have a responsibility to look beyond our own borders and to look to see how we can participate in working in solidarity with communities in other parts of the world.
And how can other people help?
Well, right now, one of the things that we're needing is people to come forward who are able to be in a group with a group of people to form what we call circles of hope, where they come together and they, in fact, do the raising of the funds and are there to provide support for the first year after the newcomers arrive, so that we're able to continue the work of sponsoring LGBT folks from overseas. Currently in Vancouver area, the Lower Mainland, BC, we have 17 circles that are working to do sponsorship. And so we keep getting emails from people from all over the world wanting to see if we can help them, if we can find sponsors for them. So what we really need is people to come forward who can form a circle or be part of a circle. And then there are people who probably are not in a position to be able to do that, and they can also always contribute some funds that will go towards the sponsorship for some of the circles that are already working on the sponsorship.
What is Rainbow Refugee currently working on, or what's next for the organization?
Well, recently, as in this week, I went to Ottawa to appear before the citizenship, the Immigration Standing Committee on Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship. And one of the things that we're working on is we want to ensure that this program for sponsorship becomes a permanent feature in the immigration process, because right now it's still a pilot where we have to keep applying to get it renewed. So we want it to become a regular feature. So that's one thing we're working on. The second thing that we're working on is the concern around the length of processing time for people overseas. For example, a couple of the different sponsorship groups are sponsoring folks who are in countries where the processing time is 6.25 years. And so for LGBT couple individuals who are living outside their own country, and oftentimes in other countries that are equally hostile to them, to be sitting and waiting, having to wait 4 years, 5 years, until their application is actually processed, is totally unacceptable to us. And so when I was in Ottawa this past week, that was one of the issues that we raised, because immigration is looking at measures that they can introduce to better protect vulnerable persons. And so from our perspective, members of our communities, in fact, all are vulnerable persons because of the seriousness of the persecution that they experience in their home country and also in the host country. So we're trying to pressure the, or at least inform and hopefully pressure the department to take a serious look at how they can reduce processing times and how they can give priority to the processing of LGBT applications from overseas.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome. Okay, Emily, thank you.
Stone cold, don't you know you are my heartache? And I'll go fooling around and chasing old mistakes. You'll be screaming out for more when I'm halfway out the door someday. Give me 10 to count of four, 'cause I know you. Take off your clothes and touch the lips that you'll be kissing.
You just heard Body Was Made by Ezra Furman, and before that was Beast Is Me by Ray Spoon and Savannah by The Clicks. And Ray Spoon also has a great musical doc called My Prairie Home about growing up queer in a Pentecostal family that you should check out. I'm going to take a quick PSA break, but keep listening for more Pride programming on CITR.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Hi, you're listening to CITR. My name is Paula, and this is Pride Facts. I have words for you, words that have been reclaimed by the LGBTQ plus community. Reclaiming language is taking words that have been used to degrade a community and turning the meaning around. Taking away the negative connotation of the words can be liberating. Let's take a closer look at the word queer and its history. Originally, it was used in 16th century Scotland to mean peculiar or eccentric. Contemporary synonyms of the word are odd, unusual, strange. The word, used as a term towards the LGBTQ plus community in the late 19th century, was reclaimed in the 1990s by a New York-based group of activists named Queer Nation. Their aim was to take the word out of violators' mouth and give it a positive connotation by self-identifying as queer. The famous slogan, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it," was coined by the group. The word queer is still considered offensive by some members of the LGBTQ community. Many feel uncomfortable using a word that caused them so much harm. Why use it then? Advocates for the usage of the word queer use it as an adequate umbrella term for LGBTQ+. It is considered inclusive of all sexual orientations and non-binary, unlike the terms lesbian or gay. Create your vocabulary app by checking out the following web pages: positivespace.ubc.ca/terminology, www.glad.org/reference/transgender, www.autostraddle.com. Check out the series More Than Words. They discuss queer words. Happy Pride, everyone.
Welcome back. You're listening to Pride programming on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver, or streaming from CITR.ca. Right now, I have an interview with Telen Kuslick, one of the organizers of Vancouver's 2016 Trans, Transgender, Transsexual, Two-Spirit, Genderqueer, and Intersex March.
The 2016 Trans, Two-Spirit, Genderqueer, and Intersex Pride March will take place on July 29th. Organizer Telen Kuslick spoke with me about the march, Pride, and trans activism in Vancouver. What's the idea or purpose behind the Trans March?
Well, it's always been sort of a dual purpose. So the dual purpose is both a fight for liberation, so, you know, a way to sort of raise up ourselves and speak out against discrimination, against other forms of oppression, against the violence that trans people suffer all over the world, and including in Canada. But then the other part is the sort of the celebration part, right, and being able to have a space to sort of celebrate the trans community and to come together and say and be happy about being around each other. So it's not, you know, there's part of it which is anger at the state of affairs, but part of it is also, you know, happiness and celebration. And we're really excited to be here and to show, you know, off how big and powerful and great our community is.
So how did you get involved in organizing it, or why did you want to be organizing it?
That's a good question. I used to do a lot more organizing back when I was a student, so that would have been like, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. This year, what was going on with a lot of the organizers who've been doing it in previous years were not able to do it anymore this year, and so there was a call out for new people to come in, and I felt like I had the time this summer to put into it. So definitely something I have done and I have participated in every year that I've been in Vancouver, and it's been happening. Yeah, I haven't. This is actually my first year being part of the organizing collective for this Trans March. Yeah, it's mostly because there was a need for people, and I felt like I had the time and energy to put into it, and because I felt like it's something that I've always been able to get a lot out of, and so, you know, want to be able to put something back in.
And what has the turnout been like in previous years?
In the thousands. So I think someone gave an estimate of 3,000 last year. So it's a lot of people. It was two blocks of Commercial Drive last year that we occupied. So, and then I think it was two lanes of traffic we had blocked. So two blocks long times two lanes of traffic wide. I think that's where they got the estimate of 3,000 people from.
It's not just called the Trans March. It includes the terms genderqueer, intersex, and two-spirit. Why was it important to include that?
We oftentimes will use trans as an umbrella term, but it's one of these things that sometimes it's not 100% clear who is included under the umbrella. I mean, historically, certainly, like, the term trans has mostly been referring to, you know, transgender and transsexual people, which would be specifically folks who are actually sort of, you know, moving from one side of the gender spectrum towards the other. And there's a lot of other folks who don't really necessarily fall into that narrative, but we do feel are part of, you know, the community that we want to be represented at the march. So genderqueer folk are also another umbrella term. It refers to a bunch of different gender identities that people occupy when they don't necessarily feel that they fit into either the male or female sort of parts of the gender binary. So the intersex refers to folks whose assigned sex is neither, well, actually, no, some of them are still assigned male or assigned female, but whose biological sex is somewhere between male and female. So then, I mean, at that point, you can't really say, you know, they can't really necessarily fit into the trans narrative because they're not necessarily moving from one side to the other. They're starting at some point somewhere closer to the middle. And two-spirit is specifically gender and sexual identity that, like, Native folks occupy. That's part of Native tradition. That is something that, you know, it's an Indigenous tradition, and it's important for us to include that term because there's a lot of folks who feel that, you know, identifying as trans would in some way be assimilating into the dominant white settler culture, and that that's not necessarily, and that partly that that term doesn't necessarily fit people because it is from a culture which they don't, that's not necessarily their culture. So, yeah.
And I've read that you've tried to make the march as accessible as possible. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So I feel like there's something we've been putting a specific extra sort of emphasis on this year. I mean, certainly in terms of physical accessibility, we were making a point of trying to make sure anyone who's moving slower is at the front of the march so that the people behind sort of stay at the pace of the slowest people. So that includes folks who are using wheelchairs, it includes folks who are walking but walking slowly. But we also have a van that's going to be following the march that has one wheelchair accessible spot in it. So if there's folks who are, you know, have physical disabilities or are using a wheelchair as a mobility device and are not able to be at the front of the march with a group of people who are moving slowly, it's also perfectly possible for them to ride in that van. And there's also some, there's one wheelchair accessible spot, and I believe there's four other passenger spots in that van. So if there's other folks who cannot walk the length of the march or move the length of the march, then there's space in that van for them. We're also working on communications accessibility. We have ASL interpreters this year to make sure that our march is accessible to deaf folks and hard of hearing folks. We are also trying to make our march as accessible as possible to folks who have other barriers in trying to get there. So we have some bus tickets available if there are folks who need help in getting to the march. We're going to have some food available afterwards so that, you know, folks can have something to eat. Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's really important to us because we want to make sure that all trans people are able to attend. I mean, I still know that even because of that, there are still going to be other barriers that we haven't thought of. But we're doing our best to try to, you know, reduce the barriers that we have thought of. So
there's been a lot of arguments in the past few years that Pride, especially the main parade, has become sort of commercialized and exclusionary of trans folks and people of color. Is the march sort of a way to take that back?
It has been, certainly. To be honest, I actually feel like the past couple years, Pride has done a much better job of, you know, we're sort of bringing some of the, you know, trans issues to the forefront than they had in years before that. At the same time, there's definitely a certain extent to which, you know, when I have marched as part of the Pride Parade, I have not felt like I really fit in. Like, there's definitely a certain extent to which I feel like most of the folks who are in the Pride Parade aren't there to, you know, fight for rights or to, you know, fight for anything, and are mostly just there to be, like, to celebrate and to have fun. And I feel like there's a certain extent to which in the trans community we still have a lot less of the rights that the, you know, that cisgender queer folk can take for granted. So, for example, human rights protection in BC, that still doesn't exist yet. There was just an announcement made earlier this week that it should be happening. I mean, having an announcement of you know, the legislation should be changing, and it actually changing, or not necessarily always the same thing. But certainly, you know, cisgender queer folk have had that protection in human rights law on the basis of sexual orientation a lot longer. And so it's definitely something that there is a certain extent to which when you're marching as part of a larger pride parade, there isn't, definitely I feel like our voices were drowned out by the folks who were more sort of into, you know, having a good time and enjoying the rights that they already had, rather than fighting for the rights that they didn't yet have. And the other thing I was going to say about, so part of the purpose of the trans march is to have a more explicitly political and more explicitly sort of protest-oriented march. I mean, and also part of that is to be able to make sure that, you know, the march is not turned into a parade. You know, trans march is very much not a parade. It is a protest march. I mean, it's also a celebratory protest march as well as a, you know, it's not all anger. Here we're actually making a point of having a no-banner policy because we felt that in previous years there were some businesses and organizations that were trying to use the march as an opportunity for promotion, and we feel like that we want to keep the focus on individuals rather than on organizations. We want to keep the focus on, you know, who are we, what's our community, and what rights are we fighting for, as opposed to, you know, what are the organizations out there that want to get the attention of the trans community, because that's really not what the march is for.
What would you say the challenges facing the trans community today are? What are you currently fighting towards?
Well, I was going to say the one that I've actually been most involved in this spring has been the BC Human Rights Legislation one, and that, again, as of the announcement earlier this week, that is now sounds like it's going to be changing. There's definitely a lot of challenges facing the trans community in terms of healthcare, in terms of being able to access hormones and surgeries, and specifically for folks who are outside of Vancouver and outside of the Lower Mainland. Definitely a lot of the trans healthcare that's available in BC currently is only available through Vancouver Coastal Health, and the efforts to try to change that are not happening nearly as fast as we'd like them to. So folks who are in the Okanagan, or folks who are in Prince George, or even folks who are in the Fraser Valley, oftentimes are not able to access the healthcare needs that folks in Vancouver, I guess at this point, are almost like taking for granted, right? And there's also an issue of making sure that, to be honest, I mean, one of the things that I always say is, you know, a big fight for the trans community is the fight for decriminalization of sex work. I mean, the trans community has always been overrepresented among sex workers and has always been marginalized partially because of the criminalization of sex work and the activities surrounding it. And as long as people are criminalized, it'll never be safe. The work will never be safe for them as long as they cannot go to the police to report people who are doing violence against them, who are robbing them. Yeah, the only way to actually make sex workers safe is decriminalization. So.
And what would you say makes a good ally for the community?
Oh, boy. I mean, I feel like the first thing is to be open-minded and not to make assumptions. I feel like there's this sort of this one trans narrative that it always comes out, you know, about like, you know, oh, I was born into the wrong body, that I feel like more and more trans people I know don't feel like that fits them. In fact, I feel like now it's a minority that actually feel like they fit that narrative. So I feel like being able to be open-minded is important. I feel like being able to be willing to come out and help the trans community. I mean, we do so much stuff to help the broader queer community that, you know, just being able to come out and volunteer, for example. We're still looking for more marshals for our march. So if anyone's interested in volunteering, that would be a great thing to do as an ally. And being able to come out and listen to us. And, I mean, I feel like one of the things that's always, that being an ally, as well as it, you know, meaning sort of standing in solidarity with us, it also means being able to let us do the talking some of the time, not try to speak for the trans community, but to try to let the trans community speak for ourselves.
And for people who want to come out and participate in the march, what do they need to know? What are the details?
The march starts on Friday, July 29th. Basically, we're gathering somewhere between 5 and 5:30. At 5:30, there's going to be welcoming and stuff like that, and the actual march is going to start at 6, and that's at Clark Park. So if you're coming, I mean, I guess the main thing to know is that it is, 17 blocks long march, so be prepared to either walk or move however, or you're able, or, get in touch with us if you need one of the spots in the van. We have a couple policies which are going to make important for folks who are attending the march. So the one of them is the no banner policy that I mentioned earlier. Another one is the fact that we're trying to make our space as accessible as possible to folks who have environmental allergies, so specifically smoke and scents. So people are asked not to wear scented products like colognes and perfumes and deodorants to the march. We're also asking folks not to light up or vape up during the march because there are organizers, performers, and volunteers who have allergies to smoke. So if folks need to, get their nicotine fix, they're asked to, leave the march or to leave the park where we're having our post-march festival in order to do that.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
That was Telen Kuselik talking about the 2016 Vancouver Trans March, which is going to take place on July 29th. If you're interested in volunteering, performing, or learning more, you can contact the organizers through their Facebook page or website at transpridevancouver.wordpress.com. That's it for my Hour of Pride programming. My name is Emily Blake, and thanks for listening. Now we have the award-winning documentary Queer Decade by Heather Kitching. It's about gay marriage activism in Canada and is part of CITR's UBC Centennial Documentary Series.
Hello, you're listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral, unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes containing an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station from 1949 to the late 90s. With help from the UBC University Archives and the UBC Library Digitization Center, 400 audio files are now available for the public to listen and download, with more on the way. To share this history, we have made a series of documentaries produced by students and community broadcasters. This project is funded by UBC's Centennial Initiative Fund, celebrating a century of success at UBC. Tune in every Thursday at 4 p.m. for the next 4 weeks from January 14th to February 4th